All right, good morning, everybody. So we're going to get started. So welcome to the first of our rotation presentations. This is really exciting. I think you're going to be very happy with what people have accomplished. So what's going to happen right now is we have four research groups, and my guys are going to go first, and that'll take roughly an hour. And then after that, Lydia and Mike's group will go, and that'll take about 30 minutes or so, and then we'll have a short break, 15 minutes, and then the other two groups will go after that, each 45 minutes, so that's Erhan and Jitsu's group. And then after that, we'd like to ask the students to go with us over to the lab, and we're going to do a cleanup so that the lab is ready for the other groups who are going to be working hard over the weekend to make sure that on Monday morning you can start this all over again. 4:30 is when we're going to pick up the food for this evening, and so those of you that want, you can meet at the beach, the usual beach where we've been meeting at 5 p.m., and there'll be food that comes coming from Silver Greens. So
maybe grab a drink from, grab whatever you're going to be drinking from the lab.
Yeah. So I just want to, first of all, say thank you to the KITP people for an amazing job of preparing all this. Eileen really helped us enormously, and Boris, and Bars, and Maggie, Amanda, and then I want to thank
Sebastian.
Sorry?
And Sebastian.
And Sebastian, thank you. So next I want to acknowledge my TAs, so Griffin and Rob, so thank you guys very much for coming here, and then the students, it was great to work with you guys. And so without any further ado, Maria, take it away.
Good morning, my name is Maria, und es freut mich, dass ihr heute alle gekommen seid. All right, so why theory? Why did we want to do the theory rotation? So for me, often when I go to talks or read papers, then I feel like a significant part, often the most interesting part, is written in a different language, a language that I won't understand because it's a language of equations. So in the last 2 weeks, we've tried to learn a new language. And I mean, you all know if you've tried that. In 2 weeks, you can't get very far, but we had a very patient teacher, so we'll now show you how far we got. And I think I can order pizza by now. And more importantly, I think I can ask for directions now, in theory. So here are the topics that we've covered. We covered the basics of street fighting mathematics. We covered probability distributions and mass equations. We did some statistical mechanics and worked on cooperativity. And in all of these five subjects, we'll give like small introductions. And then we'll show you a bit more about the two bigger parts that we worked on, which is on how biology achieves specificity and on population genetics. So I will start off with street fighting mathematics. So what is street fighting mathematics? The basics of it is you have very little information and you want to make an educated guess on it. So in this example, the only information we have is a picture of a phage that has spilled out its DNA. And now we want to guess the size of that phage's genome. And how do we do that? Initially, we just want to estimate the size of the blob. And we do that by thinking, all right, how big could that blob be? It definitely has to be bigger than 200 nanometers. So our lower guess is 500 nanometer. And then we go approach this value that we think is our real guess from the top, and we think, all right, it cannot be a millimeter big. And then if I go down from the top, I reach the value of 2,000 nanometer, where I think, like, all right, below that value, it could be possible. And then if I take combine these two guesses, I end up with the guess that this is under nanometer. But still, this is only the guess of the size of the blob. So how do I go from this now to the actual length of the DNA chain? And I want to illustrate this with this chain of paper clips, which is basically like the length of the DNA. And if I now drop it down, it forms a blob on the floor, which you can't see. But I now want to say that from the size of this blob, I think I can estimate how long the chain length was. And to do this, we will make use of the random walk model. And if we then plug in the parameters that we know just from the picture, and we get to a genome size of 30,000 base pairs for this phage. And I admit that this value is a bit off from the literature value, but there might actually be a biological reason, and that is that in the phage's head, the DNA is fixed So basically, we cannot drop the whole length. We have to drop it fixed in the middle. And if we do that, then the blob gets smaller. So basically, the real phage's genome size is bigger, because then we would estimate just from the picture, because our initial like how we saw the system was slightly wrong. So this is just the first start of what street fighting mathematics can do, and now Stephanie will give some more examples for it.
All right, I guess we have to record ourselves. But at any rate, from the previous example, we can see how street fighting mathematics is a powerful approach for being able to estimate parameters that at one point or another would have been difficult to determine experimentally. But I think it's also a very powerful approach for contextualizing numbers we already have in biology. Because I think, you know, we deal with proteins, we deal with ions when we think about the cell, but I think it's difficult really to truly appreciate the relative scope of these numbers. So I'd like to ask you for your opinions on these questions. So does anyone have an idea of how many hydrogen ions there are in a particular cell? So maybe let's pick our favorite, like E. coli. Assume a good physiological pH of like 7.4. Does anyone have an idea for me? I will call on you if you don't raise your hand. So.
100.
100. Well then. So Stephanie is from Rob's group. But she's very correct. And I think, you know, this is a number that might, you know, seem kind of small. And it's good to put it in perspective. But what about the next question? How many proteins in a cell? We can maybe cross-reference with Stephanie. But I would like an answer from someone who's not in Rob's group, perhaps. No? Okay. Well, since all of you are not awake this morning, I'll tell you that it's 3 million proteins, actually. And I think it's also particularly interesting when you think about biochemistry and the reactions that are going on in the cell to keep in mind how far apart are these proteins, actually. And that distance is only 10 nanometers. So I think it's really powerful to like take a step back and think about what is really going on in the cell, how are things organized, because I think it gives you a better intuition about what's occurring. With that in mind, I'd also like for us to consider transcription factors, which are particularly, of course, important in these said reactions in the functionality of the cell. So the following plot is taken from Rob's book, Cell Biology by the Numbers. It was something we referred to. I would really recommend it. And what it is basically a cumulative distribution plot. So what it shows is basically activating transcription factors are only present in about 1 to 100 copies in the cell, whereas repressors are present 10 to 1,000 copies. So I think it's very useful to think about the absolute numbers. But now I'd like to make the link back to the way we usually see numbers presented in molecular biology, which is in terms of concentrations. So I challenge you to think about what the number 1 nanomolar really means. I think plenty of us have set up, you know, PCRs and other sort of reactions where numbers on, you know, concentrations on this order of magnitude are frequently encountered. But to help you appreciate this number, think about the bacterial cell. Again, let's think about E. coli. If we approximate it as a cube with a side length of 1 micron, it has a volume of 1 micron cubed, which converting to liters is actually 10 to the negative 15 liters. So that's only a femtoliter. And then converting into using the concentration, this backs out to on the order of just 1 to a few molecules. So I think it gives you an appreciation for the sort of very specific chemistry that's taking place in the cell. And I think, you know, to sound like a real theorist, that's very beautiful. But I think it also highlights the problem of small numbers and also how these molecules then get allocated between dividing cells from the parents to their daughter, which is what Gita will talk about next.
So in addition to street fighting math, we also learned about various probability distributions. Probably my favorite one is the binomial, because we learned in the class that you can derive many different distributions from it. It's essentially like the mother of several other distributions. And it can be used to model very interesting biological processes. For example, when you have a cell that's dividing, it needs to pass down its cellular ingredients, such as proteins and mRNAs, and it needs to do it in a way that both daughter cells get an equal number of, or more or less an equal number of molecules. So This process can be modeled as a series of coin flips, essentially. You can ask, given n proteins in the mother cell, what's the probability that I'll end up with k proteins in one of the daughter cells? And that's analogous to asking, given n coin flips, how many heads will I get? What's the probability that I'll get k heads? So you may be wondering, okay, so where do values of n and k come from experimentally? So people have figured out how to do this. In terms of counting proteins, they attach fluorescent proteins onto the proteins that they want to monitor, and they use fluorescence imaging to essentially use the fluorescence of each cell as a proxy for the number of proteins that ends up in each cell. And I say a proxy because the intensity is only linearly related to the number of molecules through the calibration parameter alpha, which is different across various instruments. And so that needs to be figured out. To figure this out, the calibration parameter, we were able to derive this expression by knowing that if the partitioning is truly random, then the fluctuations or the differences in the intensities of the two daughter cells will also obey binomial statistics. And so we created a simulation that essentially simulates hundreds of cell divisions and across various values of n. And we were able to attain the alpha calibration parameter with this, which is basically the slope of the red line in this plot.
Right. So actually, the probability of distribution is not only useful for understanding the static condition inside the cell, it is also useful to allow us to understand the dynamic system in the cell, such as the gene expression. So without doing any experiment, how can we know the distribution of messenger RNA in a population? So as long as we know the production rate of the messenger RNA, which is denoted as R here, and also degradation of messenger RNA, which is denoted as gamma here, we will be able to write down a master equation, and that describes the probability of a given species of messenger RNA along with the time. And then with a very successful MATLAB code, we will be able to plot how this dynamic can change along with the time. And imagine this plot to show you what could happen at the very beginning of the transcription. And at the time zero, actually you got none of the messenger RNA is expressed. So the probability of a zero amount of messenger RNA is one. However, once the transcription happens, then this probability is going to shift to the copy number with more messenger RNA. And the most interesting thing about this plot is the sum of the all possible probability equals to one. That means like during this dynamic, is only the probability is only shift from this point and then to the other points. And this behavior is very much like you got the bread and then you put the butter on the top of your bread and you start to spread the butter on the bread. And then you are going to get more even distribution of the bread on your butter, but you don't lose any butter at all. So that's why we call this is a spread the butter model. And on the other hand, the probability is also useful to allow us to know the behavior between ligand binding and receptor. And we know that cooperativity is a very common feature between ligand and receptor, which means if you got one ligand binding to this receptor, it can facilitate the binding of the second one and make the second one bind strongly to this receptor. How can we like visualize or think about this thing in a more theoretical framework? So we learn how to use the thermodynamic model to model the probability of each state. For example, the state of no ligand binding and one ligand binding and two ligand binding. And indeed, the probability of each state is proportional to the energy of that state and also proportional to how many ways you can get to that state. That is so-called multiplicity. And we write down this kind of fancy equation, and then we also got a very cool MATLAB code. And then indeed, the result really fits our expectation. And the top graph showing that if the cooperativity is low, then you will find a concentration where you can find the coexistence of the three states. However, when the cooperativity gets very high, then the system becomes like a switch-like behavior, which means at low concentration, you will only have no ligand binding, and at very high concentration, you will end up with two ligand bindings. And this like qualitative behavior is in line with what we learn in the biochemistry book about the Hill's function.
In the same way, we can calculate a probability of a receptor binding different ligands, and the error rate of binding the probability of binding a wrong ligand is in proportion to the ratio of KDs. And we plot the error rate against this ratio, and you can find that even if the ratio is 100, the error rate is still too high for the cell, because the error rate of translation is around here and the transcription around here, but the error rate under equilibrium is around here. So we need the help of Maxwell's demon. Here is a box with two kind of molecules move randomly. And imagine that there is a demon that only opens the door when the yellow guys move to the left and the blue guys move to the right. And so the Gibbs free energy of this system will be increased, and we can collect all what we want in one side of the box. This process also happens inside of cells, like the behavior of ion channel. And let's go back to our example. Cells here can consume ATP to induce a conformational change of this receptor, and this conformational change can further lead to a change of the KD. So the error rate here is reduced by a factor of new ratio of KDs. So cells is actually fitting the demon to work harder to reduce the error rate. However, the ATP here is not always necessary. This conformational change can be simply induced by certain binding of ligands. So in this scenario, error rate can also be reduced. But the question is the cell still pay for it? And if yes, where is the energy go? I will be working on this question during my next rotation, so you can still stay tuned.
Okay. So this concept of biological specificity also applies to a system I'm sure you've all heard of, the CRISPR-Cas9 system, and more broadly genome engineering, which is an area that has garnered considerable interest recently. So simply, the CRISPR-Cas9 system, which was adapted from the bacterial immune system, allows for targeted and precise genome editing by means of the complex that's formed between this nuclease protein, the Cas9, and an RNA sequence. So the RNA sequence, which is commonly referred to as the guide RNA, and it's shown in this diagram in blue, is complementary to the DNA strand of interest where you would like to cut, and allows for the Cas9 protein to cut between particular specific base pairs. So you can see that the flexibility of this system, which is conferred by this guide RNA protein that can be swapped in and out based on the sequence you're interested in targeting, is very powerful and allows for targeted modification. However, in the literature, there have been reports of off-target effects, that is, when this CRISPR-Cas9 complex actually is not only able to cleave the sequence you've specified, but similar sequences as well. So this made me particularly interested in applying all the topics we had learned about regarding biological specificity to this model to better understand perhaps the modulation of off-target effects. So in order to do this, I decided to reduce the problem and only focus on this issue of hybridization, that is, between what is shown in the red, the DNA sequence, and what is shown in the blue, the guide RNA sequence. I thought this would be a great way to take a step back and look at the energetics of the process, simply to calculate the Gibbs free energy of different sequences, that is, specified guides and the off-target sequences, and to go from there, because as you might imagine, the appropriate target DNA sequence and the guide RNA, binding would be very energetically favorable, but binding between an off-target sequence and the guide RNA would be less energetically so. So, for example, I'm taking into account an example from the literature. And for simplicity, I understand this is not a representation of complementarity. I just wanted to show the alignment, if you will, between the DNA and then the RNA represented just in DNA bases. So from this example in the literature, you can see, you know, perfect matches in sequence between the intended template and the guide. And we can actually calculate the Gibbs free energy for this sort of arrangement using progressively more complicated models, which is what I've been working on. I've also been comparing this with other available sort of sequence combinations reported in the literature. And for example, you can see here, there are in fact mismatches. So when, you know, put together, these would not be perfectly complementary. And as you might imagine, the Gibbs free energy of this DNA RNA hybridization is in fact lower. So what I've been interested in doing is going through and developing successively more complicated models of DNA RNA hybridization, and then comparing them with reported off-target activity in the literature to gain a better understanding. And this is something that I'm going to also be continuing in the upcoming rotation. But I think what we'd like to really share with you is the fact we've really enjoyed applying theory to problems that are of interest to us in biology. And we wanted to wrap up kind of also by allowing us all to be theorists for a little bit this morning. So,
right. So we also learned about population genetics through this very beautiful experiment done by Beery in the 1910. So what he was interested in was how allele frequencies change in small finite populations. So he basically started out with a population of heterozygous flies, which had orange eyes, because they had the red and the white eye allele. And he would randomly mate these guys and girls, I guess, and take their offsprings randomly and randomly mate them as well, and continued doing this until about like 20 generations. And what he saw is pretty remarkable. What he saw was that depending on the replicate, one of the alleles fixed. So all the heterozygous flies turned into homozygous flies. And we actually derived these distributions both analytically and numerically. And we're curious to see whether we can run an experiment with you guys using cards to also show these distributions. So Maria will actually explain the rules of the game.
Okay, so now the game is basically like this. We have two flies to start off with. Both of them carry both alleles. So this fly has a red and a black allele, and also this fly has a black and a red allele. So what we're now going to do is just randomly shuffle their alleles and pull out four times and see which alleles we will get. So if I pull the first time, it's red. And again, it's red. And again, it's red. And black. So now, in one generation, basically, we shifted from the 50-50 distribution to three red ones and one black one. And you can see that if you would have only two flies and would go really fast, that it would fix either to all being red or all being black. But we're now going to play the game a bit more advanced, which is with three flies. So Gita will get one set of cards, and I will get one set of cards. And I don't think we need the microphone. So it's basically a race who can make it fix faster, them or us.
Go, Gita.
Black. Red.
Red.
Go, Maria.
Red.
Red.
Black.
Red.
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 Red. Okay, now I need to exchange one of the cards for a red one. For which one do we have one?
Red.
Okay. So I need four red cards and two black cards. And then we go into the second generation.
The card shark.
Red?
Red.
Red?
Hello, Rita.
Red. Red.
Ooh, red.
And red! But we had some yesterday where the six cards people were fixing the five or six generations game went basically on. So I don't want to do that to you today. So now you've seen like a fast, quick example of population genetics, but actually Phoebe did her theory project in conjunction together with my bench school, so you'll hear more about population genetics from her.
Right, so like I'm going to share you like a small project that I have been working with Mike, and we are trying to build a small, simple model, and then to explain how a diversification during evolution could happen. So the question is really got us interested is how does a heterodimeric protein complex can resolve the cross-tail interaction after whole genome duplication? So what I meant is imagine. This is one protein, and this is the other one protein. You can think this guy as a ligand, and this guy as a receptor. And so they originally interact very well and very specifically with each other. But after whole genome duplication, you got one more copy of this guy, and you also got one more copy of the other guy. And now the existence of the duplicate copy actually make the interaction become more complicated because these two are very similar. So this guy can interact with these two proteins, and so as for this protein, it can interact with these two proteins. So at a very initial stage, you will have a probability to have the crosstalk between these two proteins. However, like we do know from several studies, and then it's possible during evolution, it can resolve this kind of crosstalk interaction and reestablish a very specific protein interaction, so you end up with two functional protein pairs. And how can this process happen? This is a question so we would like to address by writing a simple MATLAB code and then let us know what kind of parameters can tune the process, this process. Yes. And so before I go to discuss like the rationale and all of the things I have been trying, I would like to thank Mike and Christian for getting me thinking about these questions, and also thank many theorists in our course like who told me a lot about like how to do the math and also how to write a successful code. And so like in a simple scenario, we would like to just consider the neutral evolution so that we can only consider how the mutation rate can affect this process without worrying about the population size and also selective advantage of each state. And so there are several assumptions I made before like writing down the code. The first assumption is I assume that the mutation rate of loss of protein interaction is way more higher than the mutation rate of gain of protein interaction. And I will use a U loss representing the mutation rate of loss of interaction and U gain representing for the gain of protein interaction in the following slides. And in addition, I also assume that the initial step is very unique to the whole process because at the first step, only the loss of interaction can happen, and once it happens, it allows loss of the two interactions simultaneously, and this event won't be able to occur in the next steps. The reason is, as long as the evolution goes and there are more mutations accumulated, so that make these two paralogous proteins look differently and also bind differently. And in order to like tackle this question, the rationale is like, can we understand how this interaction changes along with the time? And the idea is, if I can come up with how many possible states from this stage to through the evolution, and if I can come up with I can know the transition frequency between each state, then I will be able to use the multiplication of the matrix and written down some format like this. Say that after step one, then the state of the step one will be equal to the transition matrix one times the initial state. And I'm going to take this state, undergo the second transition matrix for several rounds, and then I will be able to know how the process looks like. So this is the very short result. And when the U loss bigger than the U gain, I see that indeed the state one, which is the initial state, dies out very quickly, and the state 7, which only has one pair of protein interaction, fixed like in the long term. And the state we were originally interested is this state 4, which can maintain two pairs of protein interaction. Actually, it shows up at very beginning stage, but it dies out again. So this simple model looks pretty cool, and it gave us a very simple framework to start with. And we can further ask that how does this fixation pattern can change under selection regime? And then, so the way we are going to do this is we can assign the fitness value to each state, and then we can rewrite a new transition matrix, which incorporate the population size and also the fixation probability of each state, and apply the same logic to tackle these questions.
Okay, so in the end, we want to just summarize what we've learned and why we think theory is cool. So I love theory because it allows me to do biology in a more quantitative way, and it gives me a new perspective on biology.
I love biology because it provides a really nice sort of reality check on experiments. What do I like? What do I like? I like biology. Maybe I need to get back in lab. I'm really tired. Sorry, guys. So yes, I really like theory because I think it's a really important way to inform and counterbalance your experiments. And I would also like to say that we really need to thank Rob for breaking it down for us. And if you'd like to know where the quotes are coming from, it's there's a great video from his time at MBL. So you should ask him about it. But yeah, really, he was very enthusiastic, very patient, made these concepts very accessible for us. So we're really thankful for a really great rotation with you. This was great.
Okay, I like theory because it can allow me to think about what people mean about meta-concept in a complex biological system.
I love theory because it's beautiful and it's useful. It's a poem of reason.
Okay, well, I love theory because the more I learn biology, the more I realize it's an umbrella term for all the physics that we don't yet understand.
Okay.
Thank you.
Brewster Group, you guys are next. I like the equations in the sand. No, but I don't think it's that.
Yeah.
We're going to ask the monster when we go.
Okay. That doesn't work. We're going to just the other one. Okay.
You don't need to advance.
No, so we would like to have like two different things at the same time. But it's not. Just capping.
Good morning. I'm Savita.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Paul.
Jorge?
So for the last 2 weeks, we have been betting, hedging our bets on natural isolates to tell us something interesting about their lives in a very brief period of 2 weeks. And before we tell you about more about this story, let me tell you that back home I have been working with populations. So mostly the readout is at population level study, not the at the population level readouts. And this was my opportunity to peep into the lives of the individuals in the population. And I must say I enjoyed it thoroughly. Well, we are not the only one living in uncertainties and unpredictabilities of life. Microbes do it all the time. And E. coli, our pet, is no different from others. So E. coli, its primary habitat is actually mammalian gut, but it is found almost in every other secondary habitats. So in addition to, so these habitats are actually fluctuating environments where they are faced with a lot of uncertainties about the physiochemical changes happening in their niche, as well as the most common one is the variability in the sugar substrates availability. So one asks this question, how do these bugs behave in such fluctuating environments when they're exposed with, say, multiple sugar substrates? And I must say, in a very orderly fashion indeed. And the answer to that came actually from the first classical experiments done by Jax and Mono when they were growing E. coli in a mixed in a mixture of glucose and lactose medium. So they observed this interesting growth curve, which they called dioxy, because as it is characterized by two exponential growth curves that are separated by a brief lag. So further experimentation, they showed that the first exponential phase is due to the preferential exhaustion of glucose. And then there is this brief lag period is to prepare for making this transition to the next phase. And this time they spend in accumulating enzymes required to break down lactose. However, these are population levels, these are all population level readouts. And now with increasing data available at the single cell level studies has made a paradigm shift in this, which suggests that not everybody in the population is committed to make that switch, and there is a small fraction that is already present during this phase, which actually seeds the next exponential phase. Now, we decided to ask this question to the natural isolates because they occupy diverse habitats and they are regularly exposed to probably variable ability of lactose. And for that, we had a naive guess, as Jorge puts it, that we might see a noise in this gene LAGZ expression with more noise in the organisms that live in the mammalian gut, as that might there they might have a higher chance of facing lactose in the gut as compared to the chakalaka, which is again Jorge's favorite bird. He might not actually have lactose, as much lactose in the gut. Now, to put that LAGZ in perspective, why LAGZ? So this is a lac operon. This is a genetic system which is required for the uptake and utilization of lactose. So the operon term is used to tell the spatial organization of a set of genes which are often involved in the similar process, in this case, lactose uptake and breakdown, regulated under a common regulatory unit. And the expression of this operon depends on positive regulator CAP, cyclic AMP, and repressor LACI, which is expressed upstream of this operon. In addition to that, it's the functional status of these regulators is further regulated by the presence and absence of glucose. So when glucose is present, it reduces cyclic AMP level, hence the positive regulator, and excludes the import of lactose, which is also required to make an inducer to lock this repressor in a non-functional state. So if glucose is present in the medium, lactose becomes irrelevant and operon remains off. When lactose is not there, glucose is absent, then lactose is taken up by the permease and broken and converted into an inducer by beta galactosidase, which is encoded by LACZ, into allolactose, which is the real inducer of this operon, and hence the operon becomes is revved up to the full expression. So we decided to use LACZ as a proxy to read out the variable gene expression of lac operon, and decided to count LACZ mRNAs in the natural isolates. So to do that, we used in fish fluorescent in situ hybridization, which Kevin will explain in detail.
So as you mentioned, we were trying to count single mRNAs in an individual cell, so we want to be able to get a individual resolution for how individual cells in our population are expressing LACZ. And the way we do this is with a method called FISH, which stands for fluorescent in situ hybridization. And the way this works is when we're interested in looking at a population at a certain time point, we take a population of E. coli at that time and we fix them with formaldehyde. So this stops all enzymatic activity and freezes all of the cellular components in place. And then we make the cellular membrane permeable with ethanol, and then wash out all of any remaining junk. And then, so what we have is some mRNA that was transcribed if the E. coli was expressed in LACZ. And so we'll have some number of mRNA here. And then we have 72 little short pieces of 20 base pair long DNA that is designed to tile the LACZ mRNA. So these pieces of DNA are complementary to 20 base pair sequences of the LACZ E. coli mRNA, and they're tagged with a fluorescent dye. So then we wash these probes into the cells and then let them bind to the LACZ mRNA and hybridize. And then we wash out any excess probes so that hopefully only probes that are bound to the LACZ mRNA are still in the cell. And this whole process takes about 2 days. And then once that's done and all the probes are hopefully bound to only LACZ and only LACZ, we take an image. And so here you see individual cells. Here these guys aren't expressing. And then in fluorescence, which is coded in red, you can see individual mRNAs. And so here you can see the cell probably has 2 mRNAs here. This one probably has 1. And so then we can count how many mRNAs are in a single E. coli. That's a method we use. Now, in a minute, we'll show you some data from a whole population level of E. coli. And we took them at 3 different points when the E. coli were growing in a glucose and lactose environment. So here are the terms that we'll use for the rest of the talk. So we grew our E. coli in minimal media with 0.05% glucose and 0.1% lactose. And so here, as we explained, you expect that E. coli is only eating glucose here. And then once they exhaust the glucose, there's a brief lag period, and then they start eating lactose. And so we took one, so for each of these 3 species, Chakalaka, orangutan, and elephant, we took readings at an early glucose level. So we let them grow up to here, and then we took some samples and fixed them, and then we let them grow a little further to this mid-glucose level, analyzed those, and then we took the last sample of what we'll call glucose exhaustion, which is basically right here where they've exhausted most of the glucose and are going into the lag phase where they start to synthesize to express more highly LACZ so that they can synthesize or use the lactose. So this is important just to remember from where we sampled these populations in the following slides. But it's also very interesting because it shows that early in glucose, all 3 natural isolates behave almost identically. And then once you start getting to where they exhaust glucose, they start diverging. So orangutan goes almost immediately, has a very brief lag period, and then it's already eating lactose, and it has a very high growth rate. And elephant takes a little longer, but it has about the same lag period. But it's interesting to note that chachalaca takes a lot longer to come out of lag and is lagging quite behind the others. So this is, as Sabina suggested, is interesting because you'd expect chachalaca to have less lactose in its natural environment and may not be as ready to go to lactose as the mammals. And then, so here's our individual data. So for each of these early, mid, and glucose exhaustion, we took many pictures. And here, you see this is 10 microns. So we took 15 images for each of these that were about 130 microns by 130 microns. So for each of these cases, we analyzed about 2,000 cells. And so then we can see, count the fluorescence of mRNA. We can calibrate that to what we think a single mRNA is, and then count the total fluorescence in a single cell, and then make a distribution over all these roughly 2,000 cells for each of these. And you see some very qualitatively different distributions for the number of mRNA per cell. So this is, these are all on the same scale. This is number of mRNA per cell, and this is the probability of having that number of mRNA. And note that this is in a log scale. And see, very interesting, you get a very, a much broader tail when you get towards glucose exhaustion. And you can see with some more statistics.
So wait, when you count the mRNAs, there is some probability, maybe low, that there are two mRNAs co-localized in the same diffusion.
Can you maybe hold that thought?
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, then you get more fluorescence. So we just count the fluorescence and divide by the total fluorescence that we have for each mRNA.
Okay. So before I add more, because now I get the exciting part where I actually show the actual statistics of this thing to see if we can draw any conclusions from that. Note how if you look at the glucose exhaustion part, you'll say like, oh, you know, they all look very different. So, you know, it seems that they would not behave, you know, if I look at the six of these terms, they would probably look the same. But note how for the orangutan and the elephant, the distribution kind of goes up first and goes down. This dreamer also is in log scale, probably. It goes up and kind of goes down. And here you can actually see that it keeps decaying. I don't think we've been using the microphone, but good point.
Just put it on your sleeve.
Okay, so yeah, I was talking about the statistics, and now let's see how they look like when we look at the statistics of the old distribution. Okay, so here we're showing the same colors of what we showed in the previous slide. So this is the early stage, the mid stage, and the exhaustion period. This is the old year at which we took them, and this is the mean number of mRNAs per cell. So this is labeled according to like the color of the different animals. So you can see how for very low, for the early glucose stage, we only have, for example, the chachalaca and the orangutan only have like around one mRNA every 5 to 10 cells. This is what we get. While the elephant has like around one mRNA per cells. In this mid phase, they basically all go down to some or something of the order of one mRNA per 5 cells, one mRNA per 10 cells. And once you get to near exhaustion, they all basically go up. But you can see a huge difference between the mammals, the elephant and the orangutan, which have around, on average, but this has a huge distribution as you saw, 4 mRNAs per cell, 5 mRNAs per cell, while the chachalaca actually only has 1 mRNA per cell on average. So you can see there's a huge difference between the other, and this is the mean. But if we now look at the final factor as a proxy of how broad the distributions are. First, you notice for any theories out there is that this is definitely not Poisson. Just look at the final factor, they're all like pretty big, so they're like very far away from one. But one very interesting thing is there does not seem to be any correlation between the actual species and the final factor. So you can see how, for example, the different kinds of species, either mammals or non-mammals, and the time of time. You can see, for example, how for the chakalaka it keeps growing, for the orangutan it keeps growing, but for the elephant it goes down and goes up. That is, if you remember what Savita told you before, we would have expected as a naive guess that the chakalaka, the orangutan and the elephants, if they live in a lactose environment, they will have a greater variance to be able to take advantage of the fact that lactose may appear. But we don't see that at all from this distribution. So now, going forward to this, this is a lot, or this is the mean, this is the final factor. But one could ask, maybe the only thing that is important is maybe just having one mRNA is enough to be ready for when lactose shows up. Maybe if you just have like one vaccine, you'll be able to take advantage of start digesting lactose when it's available. So basically what we're showing you here is the fraction of cells that have at least one mRNA. And what you see here is that for the early mid stage, we have only around one every five cells for the elephant or less for the other species have more than an mRNA number. For this mid stage, it goes down a little. And once you get to the near exhaustion phase for the orangutan and the elephant, we have that around half of the cells have at least one mRNA, while the others, the chakalaka, only one every five has one mRNA. And you can see that the interesting thing is this has a very similar behavior to the
elephant.
So now just to conclude, we show you that the mRNA distribution varies significantly between samples, that there is an increased lactase expression near the glucose exhaustion that we saw, and that our naive guess that if mammalian there's more noise, this is not supported. However, our results do hint that the mammalian E. coli seem to select at least for lactase expression, which is what we showed you, and also with short lag if you look at the phenotypic of the whole population. And just to conclude, there are new questions that arise from this. What happens with the other isolates? Is it actually the mean expression or the noise? This suggests that it's the actual mean expression, but we're not sure. Maybe if you compare isolates with similar mean expression and look at their expression noise, you could actually make a reasonable conclusion. Maybe the bed catching strategy actually does work, but only if you compare things with similar mean expression. And finally, it'll be interesting to see a different isolate that evolved in varying lactobiliary environments. So here we did the mammal, not mammal, but you could think about, humans drink milk probably all their life. Baby animals are drinking milk regularly and then they stop. And adult animals drank milk at some point but they stop drinking. So it'll be interesting to see what happens when you have when you look at these different kinds of isolates. And that's it.
Thank you.
Can you show maybe a little bit more on fish analysis? So how do you know that you're looking at a single mRNA?
You guys, we need to plug in though. Seriously. Sorry, Boris, but we've got 3 hours of stuff. So.
To get a single mRNA, we have some controls that we know on average how much.
Are you integrating fluorescence?
Yes, exactly.
Fine, so you're not really counting, you can't count that many spots.
No, but okay.
So how do you know it's one mRNA?
Versus, we look at a distribution of fluorescence, and you can see you get one, and in other experiments, if you titrate it down, the number of mRNAs you're expressing, you see that fluorescence peak is in the same position, but you just have less of them. That's how you can calibrate it.
You're in the limit where you have very few, less than one per cell. One out of every 20 cells has one. Right?
That's right. That's right.
For that case, we see basically a single area of the integrated spots that they all basically cluster them, and we call that one.
Perfect.
So if they go together, we can just count the density.
Perfect.
Well, every area of the density.
That's not cool. So it has seen my computer says I'm connected to something, and the screen has been resized, but this does not look like my computation.
Is the input number matching?
Say again?
Check the input number on the VGA cable into your computer and make sure that the button in the black box underneath has the same number of words.
Don't use the PDA table.
Okay, it was just to press on. Okay, hi, hello everybody. My name is Tommaso Biancalani, and I am a theoretical physicist. However, in the last 2 weeks, I've been reprogrammed as an experimental biologist, thanks to Griffin Schuring, to Rob Felix, and to this project titled Measuring the Frequency of Horizontal Gene Transfer at Single Cell Resolution. So, in nature, there is something called horizontal gene transfer. Now, horizontal gene transfer refers to the fact that genes can be exchanged between organisms outside the conventional parent-offspring relationship. So what does that mean? Say that I have, for example, two bacteria cells, and one has gene A and the other has gene B. So these bacteria are going to replicate, and the progeny is going to inherit the genes of the parents, because this is what vertical inheritance is. However, I can also have horizontal gene transfer, which means that this organism here can, for instance, transfer this gene to the other organism, which had the gene B, but now it's going to have gene A, because it's been overwritten by this horizontal gene transfer. Now, why is a horizontal gene transfer cool? Well, first of all, it is a way to share novelty in a bacterial population. For example, it can confer an antibiotic resistance. But it is also a puzzling effect in evolutionary biologists. And this is because in evolutionary biologists, people try to quantify the degree of relatedness between species and organisms. And they do this by looking at similarities between the DNA. However, when two pieces of DNA are similar, it's very hard to tell whether they are similar because of vertical inheritance or because there was horizontal gene transfer going on. So this experiment is a step forward toward a quantitative understanding of how horizontal gene transfer works. So in particular, we've been interested in a specific way of doing horizontal gene transfer called transformation, which is done by cellular organisms, among which a model organism for transformation is B. subtilis, which is the one that we have used. So how does transformation work? Now, transformation means that my cell can uptake pieces of exogenous DNA present in the surrounding media, in this case, in the form of plasmid. So I have my cell, okay, with its DNA, and I have plasmid. What happens is that the cell enters a state called competence, which means that it grows an organelle called pilus, which can literally take the piece of the plasmid and put the DNA inside this cell. Now, when this happens, the plasmid gets unzipped, one strand gets degraded, and so the plasmid enters the cell as a linear piece of flapping DNA, which is attacked by enzyme called recombinase, and then gets integrated into the main cell. So now I'm going to stage four, which is this, and when I'm here, my cell can express the DNA of the plasmid. So can we describe competence at the level of proteins? Well, there are people who certainly can, I cannot. However, there is a simple sketch here, and for our purposes, we are interested in one protein only called COMG. Now, COMG is expressed at final stages of competence, meaning that if my cell is expressing COMG, that cell is competent. Now, a clever way to see which cells are competent is to attach a fluorescence reporter to the same promoter of COMG, meaning that when they are expressing this, they are also making some protein which turns them in some color. So I can use some fluorescence channel in my microscope to see where and which the competent cells are. So there was this strain of B. subtilis which fell from the sky, and I started working with this, which has a lot of cool properties. First of all, cells make red the whole time. So I can use red to see where the cells are. And the second thing is that cells make cyan when they become competent. So you can use the cyan channel to see who is competent and who's not. In addition to that, we can induce the competent states by using one chemical called IPT-TAG. And finally, we have the plasmid, which codes for a yellow fluorescence protein. So red stands for cell, cyan stands for competence, and yellow stands for transformers. Okay, this is how I started, and that's a glorious picture from my first day when I picked a pipette and somebody commented about the way I was taking it, probably it's not right. I still do this. Okay, so the first thing to do is to assess what's the right concentration of chemicals which make everybody competent. Actually, this was already known because Griffin has been working a lot of this. I just checked, The right value was 100 micromolar. So when the concentration of IUTG is 100 micromolar, everybody is competent. And I sort of proved this by showing you a couple of pictures. So this is a picture when we are observing cells, which is red, and here we are observing competent cells, which is cyan. However, each cell is also competent cells because it appears in both pictures. And you also see that in cyan you don't have these imperfections, like these bright spots here, which are not really cells, but are due to the fact that I can't really make that. So now we are looking at a sort of big picture. Now we are looking in yellow, so we are trying to understand here who are the transformers. Now, in this picture here, I don't know if you can see it from there, but we have bright spots, and you should see those, and they are the transformers, but we also see all the cells. Now, it's important to subtract the background noise, which technically is called the autofluorescence, which we can estimate, so that then we can count the real transformers, which are actually the bright spots. Now, here we have a concentration of IPTG such as every cell is competent, and more or less we have 1,000 plasmids per cell. Now, the real quantity we are after is the fraction of competent cells normalized, is the fraction of transformers normalized by the fraction of competent cells that I have in this image here. So, we need to count the transformers, and that's easy, but we need also to count the competent cells, which are many. So we cannot really do it by hand. We need to use a software. For instance, we can use the threshold method that we have learned in bootcamp. But there's one problem. Cells are very, very, very packed. So the threshold method does not work. And we need to use a better one. So this is an image that we have obtained by applying an edge detection method called Laplacian of Gaussian. As you can see, even though we have cluster of cells, we have a pretty good resolution. I can zoom in on one cluster and show you. Also because it's cool, the zooming itself. And so this is one cluster of cells. You can see I can really tell which are the single cell. So in this way, we can count the competent cells, and then we can compute the fractional transformers. Okay, so this is our graph, and that was the goal of our experiment. So this is the fraction of cells who are doing horizontal gene transfer as a function of the amount of plasmid that we put in. So clearly, if I don't put plasmid, I don't have transformers, that's why I have zero. And if the concentration is very small, I don't have transformers. However, as I increase my concentration, I see this sort of off curve. And here I have, like, everybody is competent, and I have, like, a 2% more or less fraction of transformers. Now, as a theorist, I wasn't worried about not having had error bars here, but theoretically, what we should have done was to repeat the experiment several times and collect a star statistics to have some sort of error here. This is what we were supposed to do, but then I thought, why don't I betray my experimental training to try to model this thing? So I spent some time working out some model, which turned out does not work, but I'm going to tell you anyway. So I basically said, let's say that we have a volume V and we have two gases. One gas is like cells and the other gas is plasmid. Now, how does transformation work? Basically, I must have one plasmid in range within one cell, which is a process analogous to a collision. So the probability of doing transformation, I can basically write as the probability of having a collision, which is easy to write down, and the probability that the cell will do horizontal gene transfer, will uptake that plasmid once that the collision is made. Now, this probability is hard. It depends on how happy the cells are, it depends on many things. But the nice thing is that this is constant. So even though it's in a known number, it's not a big deal. So I can basically follow Boltzmann and write a probability of collision as a product of concentration, and then I can just take my unknown parameter and say the probability of uptake. Now, if I do this, and I further assume that the number of cells and the number of DNA is constant, meaning that the time derivative is zero, which is true because the transformers are small. The number of competent cells, I mean, more or less, they can be, in one figure, they can be 700 where I have no transformers and 698 if I have a couple of transformers. More or less, the number is constant. So it is safe to use this assumption here. If you write down a simple stochastic model, you immediately recognize the Poisson process. And the Poisson process means that every time step you have a Poisson in the distribution, where n is the number of transformers. These are my concentration. Lambda is the parameter that I don't know. Nt is time. Now, can I test this? But intuitively, I said, well, a Poissonian distribution, the signature, the most prominent like signature of a Poissonian distribution is the fact that the mean is equal to the average. So if I segment many, many, many cells, for instance, 39,000, which does not allow me to compute the error bar for the previous graph, but it's quite a nice number. So if I segment 39,000 cell and I compute mean and variance, I should have the same order of magnitude, at least. And I totally get it, because I have 1% for the mean, and I have, let's see, this 0.93.009092. So I was really happy. Until Rob Brewster came to me and said, look, every time you have a binary sequence and the ones are rare, you're going to have this. It's just a mathematical property of something 0 and 1. Whoops. Okay, so this experience has been a lot of fun, testified by a couple of glorious pictures. We also have some conclusions. So the percentage of transformers is actually small. Even though we have 1,000 plasmid per cell, meaning that each cell collides with a lot of plasmid, the fraction of cells who do a horizontal gene transfer is very small. Can we improve it? I mean, can we change some other parameter, like media, for instance, or I don't know what else. It was at least. Oh, okay. For instance, instead of trying circular DNA like plasmid, I can try maybe linear pieces of DNA. One other question is my model right? Because I really care about that. So even though variance and mean are not good indicators, I can totally see if if I do an experiment at different times, I can see if the scaling with respect to time satisfies the Poisson-Henry relationship. I have to confess, I totally missed the big picture here, because my 2 weeks haven't been spent by acting in the right way. This is very hard. Pretty much I have finished. I can take a couple of questions here.
Maybe you guys can get set up.
Okay.
Okay.
When you say a cell is a transformer, do you mean that the plasmid gene is in the cell, or do you mean the plasmid gene is in the genome of the cell?
I mean that the plasmid gene is in the genome. So the plasmid gene is in the genome and is expressed.
Okay.
Can you apply your video?
So you know
Boris?
Go ahead. So you know that it's not possible for expression to be derived from the plasmid unless it's integrated into the genome?
So I was, as far as I understand it, the probability that the plasmid would get into the cell is circular. And however, this probability is very, very small. So I, as far as I understand, every time the virus takes my plasmid and unzips this plasmid, so I have only one strand, which is a linear piece of DNA. However, it can happen this piece, the linear piece of DNA will reclose and then will replicate and reform one plasmid. But this event is unlikely compared to the fact that the recombinants take the linear piece of DNA and integrate to the main genome. So I'm working under the assumption that every time I scale, the plasmid is into my genome and is expressed.
But I'm saying that that assumption may not be correct because there's no need for the plasmid to be linear or circular or integrated into the genome in order for you to have expression. You can still get expression off the plasmid when it's unintegrated, whether or not it's linear.
I see. Well, I mean, I see your point. Honestly, I don't know.
Maybe a related question. I guess one of the experimental lessons is to pipette, another one is to do controls. Did you check if plasmids go in without the induction of competence?
No. As far as, I mean, if the plasmid goes in, my basic biology is very good. So a plasmid can go in without, and this is not called horizontal gene transfer, like I can have events where my plasmid gets inside my cell and I don't have competence. So. But I didn't even know that was possible, honestly. This makes me a bad
story,
I guess. I know, I mean, as far as I understand the biology, as far as I learned, a cell goes competence, grow this virus, then can take this virus. And I don't understand why. Is that funny? I'm blushing.
I'm just kidding. Well, you know, it's one of the many controls that you can go into the lab.
I see. Well, now, in truth, I have like a couple of weeks to work on this, so I'm sure if you dig, you'll find many holes in my view.
I'm just kidding.
Some other questions?
Okay, I think we should move on.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, everybody take a break. Shake it out. Just going to pull it out. All right. My name's Tal. This is Ramya and Michael. We are Team Paramecium. We are led by our fearless leader, Lydia, who is the coolest postdoc ever. So we just wanted to share some of our awesome pictures and videos that we took from these past 2 weeks. It's just a really, really amazing organism. This is Paramecium, in case you missed that part. So instead of just zooming in immediately, we just want to take a step back and start from a 30,000-foot view of what this thing really looks like. So Liddy actually went and she took a sample of this thing from its natural environment. So this is what it looks like whenever it's in its home. So this is paramecium from a real pond sample from
What's
3 miles away.
What's that big thing?
The big, I mean, come on, guys. Focus on the big showy organism in the middle. Here's the paramecium. Here's another one right there. So they're super cute and adorable, and we can save the talk on the big giant worm for after lunch. Okay, so paramecium, as you can see, they're very fast swimmers, so if you're going to do any kind of statistics, you really want to slow them down, okay? So luckily, Lydia brought a really nice thing, probably the coolest substance I've ever seen. It's called methylcellulose. At 1%, it's basically water. At 3%, it's pretty viscous. So you can see that the air is slowly, slowly flowing up. And at 5%, it's basically a big, sticky glob. It's not even a solid. A solid would just fall. This thing is just stuck up there. So the bubble is slowly moving up, as you'll see. You can slam this thing down. It's just not going anywhere. So one of the things I want to ask was a nice, easy, simple experiment. What happens if you mix media with methylcellulose? How fast can the cells swim? It was wonderful because it took all of 1 minute to prepare. See, this thing, like nothing moves on this thing. Also, you can't pipette this thing. So, you know, experimental challenges. Okay, so we just did that simple experiment. That was the very beginning. So you see, in 0%, cells are nice and happy. They swim very fast. In 1%, you already get a small but noticeable slowdown. So once again, you can see they're not just quite as fast. By the time that you hit 2%, you're definitely slow. So these guys, I mean, they're not the speedy Gonzales that they were. And by 3%, this poor guy, I mean, he's trying, he's going, he's moving. But, you know, what can you do? This is also a property of methylcellulose, is it's a fibrous substance. So small things can pass easier, but the big things are basically stuck in place. So we had this wonderful data, and now we want to be cool and analyze.
So we wanted to know if, you know, using these nice videos that Tal took, whether we could explain them using some very simple physics of fluid mechanics. And so what Tal did was he took these videos and he tried to do a very rough estimate of what the maximum velocity of the paramecium cells was. And so that's on this axis here. And then we did this at these different methylcellulose concentrations that he just showed you. So you get these data points here. So like I said, we wanted to see if we could rationalize this in terms of some basic fluid mechanics. And being you know, the good physicists that we are, we said, let's assume the paramecium is a sphere. And we can use the Stokes' laws for spheres here that says that the drag force on an object is going to be proportional to its terminal velocity, v. And this proportionality constant is going to be 6 pi times the viscosity of the fluid and times the radius of the object. So now if you rewrite this, before you do that, we need to know the viscosity as a function of the methylcellulose concentration that we use. So we found some information from the vendor, and they have this kind of weird-looking empirical relation that I'm not sure where it came from, but that's what they claim, that the viscosity should be this function of the viscosity, or sorry, the viscosity should be this function of the concentration. So it's basically a power law for the concentration with some empirical constant alpha here. So now if you take that, you put that, that would go into this equation. Now you rewrite it, you should see that the maximum velocity of the cell will be inversely proportional with this power law relation to the concentration of methylcellulose, which will be in the viscosity here. So now if you just do a nonlinear fit of the data with this, you get something that actually looks rather reasonable. And this was really surprising and pleasing to us. So this was just sort of a fun little test that maybe there's actually something kind of reasonable going on here.
So what I have been interested in after looking at the swim speeds is how paramecia eat. So they have the cilia on the surface of the cell, and with this beating of the cilia, they actually trap like yeast or bacteria or anything into their oral groove, which further goes to the gullet where the food vacuoles form, and they circulate. I mean, these are the words from the Wikipedia. They circulate in the whole body before they reach the anal pore where the food vacuole ruptures and the stuff is excreted. So after reading this explanation, I was actually interested to understand how what does it mean that enough food has accumulated? Does it mean that the food vacuoles are all formed non-periodically, but they would be of the same size because they are actually measuring the amount of food which they have? Or maybe the gullet is actually beating periodically and it would just keep making food vacuoles irrespective of how much food there is in the media. So that's and when we say the vacuole circulates, does it mean that it just moves like as a random walk, or does it have any directed motion? So that's what I wanted to look at. And when we say it goes to the anal pore and it ruptures, I wanted to see if the rupture is kind of a vesicle fusion, that's a vesicle reaching a membrane and then it's fusing with the membrane. So with these questions in mind, to get data on this, as Tal mentioned, that the paramecia, they move quite a bit, so you have to make them stationary. For that, we used methyl cellulose, 3%. But it's really hard, because as soon as you put a cover slip, they just release this trichosis and they just die. So it's really, really hard to get a paramecium under a cover slip. But or else they just keep moving. So. And we fed them 1 micron red-colored beads, and we looked at them under the confocal. So that's I actually wanted to do it for different media conditions, different food concentration, but I could not get that data. However, for a single instance, the number of food vacuoles per cell, they vary quite a bit, which is, I mean, to me, surprising. And the other thing I wanted to look at is how does it scale with respect to the cell size, whether a particular, are the food vacuoles of the same size or something. I could not find any relation there, except that to say that within a cell, the food vacuoles, they seem to be of same size. But even that trend does not hold true very well. So after this, I went on to do the vacuole movement kind of a study. So here you see a paramecia in which the food vacuole is marked in red because it has just had the 1 micron beats. And we got a movie for 1.5 hours. And this is how it moves. It just makes the circles inside the cell and it just keeps moving. So it's doing this. It's this circular cycles it makes. And if you see the speed it has, so at every instance you can calculate the speed which it has, and if you make a plot of it, its fastest it's going is 6 micron per second, and it's usually in this range, but you can still cannot divide the circles with respect to the speed. They don't separate very well. And mostly it's in a smaller range. And actually you can also see the macronucleus being bumped around. So
generating that vortex
thing? Not an organelle. It's believed that the actin cytoskeleton and the myosin motors, they generate this, and this process is called as cyclosis, cytoplasmic streaming. Mm-hmm. So that shows that it's an active process and it's not just a random walk. So this is how the trajectory of the food vacuole across the whole thing looks, and we can clearly see some circles which it keeps following in the cell. The next question I asked was, how does the vesicle, once it reaches the anal pore, how does it rupture? So I'll show you the video, and I would like you to focus specifically on this region, because that's where the anal pore is. Can you see the bulge which is appearing right before it's being excreted? I was very, very surprised by the bulge. I was really surprised, because according to my intuition, when a vesicle fuses with a target membrane, I do not expect the vesicle to, the target membrane to bulge. Rather, it's on the other way around. It's not this way. So I was very surprised by the bulge, and so I went and read about this bulge, and it seems that beneath the anal pore, it's not just any membrane patch. Beneath the anal pore, there is actually a microtubule structure which is of, I don't know, maybe a T-shape kind of a thing. And once the food vacuole comes, it opens up, because of which the plasma membrane, it bulges, and the plasma membrane is exposed to which the food vacuole can fuse with. So, yeah.
So we had this really neat video, and we had a way of tracking the food vacuoles, And so I asked myself once again, is there a way to do the same kind of thing, but way easier experimentally, and in a way that hopefully gets you a lot of statistics on a bunch of different paramecium at the same time? And I mean, Ramya's movies are absolutely amazing, but it just took so many. Like, I tried to do this tens of times and failed every single time. So it's just really hard to do this way. So I asked, anything simpler that you can do? So I thought a little bit, and I decided that the easiest thing to do would be, once again, just stick them in a well, not slow them down, and see if I can track them that way. So that's how I designed what I like to call the great poop experiment. So what I did is, for 15 minutes, I fed the same kind of glowing red beads that Ramya was talking about. So I just had a well of paramecium, they're showing up here, and I put in a bunch of fluorescent red beads. So over time, over this 15 minutes, you'll see more sparkles start to show up as the paramecium eat the red beads and then drift off somewhere. So all these fireflies here are paramecium that have ingested some beads. And over 15 minutes, the beads are diffusing, unfortunately. But after the 15 minutes are done, I want to say, OK, time's up. If you haven't eaten yet, you're not going to get to eat any glowing red beads. So I suck up all of the red beads. And then I just track. For a bunch of time, I just track. So I let this go overnight. And for multiple hours, I just asked, what does it look like? So all the beads are gone, and the fireflies are moving, and they're excreting, and everybody's happy. And these little islands are forming, islands of poop. And so I just basically get to analyze this video at the end of the day and ask myself, at each point in time, how much of the stationary fluorescence is there in the images. So that's basically what I analyzed from these nice movies. And I got a result that looks like this. So over time, it kind of looks like it's a quadratic function, increasing very nicely. And so this is what I used as a proxy for my amount of poop, which I used for the proxy of the food vacuoles have gone through the paramecium and have been excreted out. So this is my high throughput method of doing this analysis. So I had this wonderful data, and I wanted to make some nice little wonderful theory on how paramecium actually do this pooping process. So the simplest thing I could think of, I knew that there was a streaming going on, so I said, okay, let's just say that there's one big circle flowing through the paramecium. And every time that the bead goes through the circle, it has some probability of being excreted out. And let's also say, just to be nice and simple, that this probability is independent of how long you've been in the paramecium. So it doesn't matter if you're in your first run or your millionth run, the same probability every time. This is nice, simple, easy. It's called an exponential distribution mathematically. And it's possibly the worst fit I've ever made to any theory in my life. So clearly wrong. I mean, there's no stretching, fitting, anything you can do to salvage this situation. Fair enough. OK, so then, you know, as a good theorist, I went back to the data and I asked, what's the next simplest theory that you can do? And I looked once again at Rami's amazing video. And I'm just going to take a second to just enjoy this. I mean, there's so much cool stuff. Notice how stationary the cell is. It is not moving at all. She just did an incredible job here. And also, there's this interesting ghost going around. I don't know if you guys can make this out. But this is a macronucleus. And it's just moving around, and it's following the streams, and it's messing everything up. And this is just incredible for so many reasons. But what I really want to ask is, how many of these circles are there? So I can count kind of one over here, two over here. There's sometimes a third one here. This is probably a fourth one. Maybe there's a fifth one. I'm not really sure. But let's just say it's somewhere between four and five circles. They're constantly changing. They're constantly moving. So my next simplest theory would be, let's say that there are four circles throughout the cell. So there's one thing, and then you have some probability of moving on to the next thing. And then you have a probability of moving on to the next one. And then you have a probability of moving on to the next one. And then you get pooped out with some probability. But you can see from this video that there's also probability that you go back to the first one up top. And that really screwed things up theoretically, but it's OK. A bit more talking with Michael. We totally got to work that out as well. So now the question is this. Let's say that you spend 1 minute on a cycle. And then you go to the next cycle for a minute. And then the next cycle for a minute. And then the next cycle for a minute. And then you go back. 2 minutes, 2 minutes, 2 minutes, 2 minutes. And you repeat this 800 times. So in total, you've been 800, 800, 800, 800 minutes. And then you get pooped out. Then the question is, how well does that fit the data? And what if it's not four cycles, but three cycles? And what if it's not four, but five? And what if it's not 800 minutes total, but 400 minutes? So we basically did another two-parameter fit. It worked so well last time with the swim speeds. So we got these nice little curves. So we basically said, how many cycles can there be? Definitely between three and six, probably four and five. And indeed, the fits were actually significantly better for the four and five cases. And then there was a prediction of how much time they should spend in each of these cycles over and over and over. So by the end, there are some quantitative predictions you can make here. For example, the total number of time that you should spend in the cell would be the product of four cycles times 470 minutes in each cycle, which is different from the product of five cycles times 330 minutes, which is very different from this. So this product here of three cycles and 800 would be 2,400 minutes, and this one would be only something like 1,600. So the next step, after getting this kind of theory, is to naturally go back and take another video like Ramya did for a much longer time and just measure how much time does the bead spend in the cell, or does it really spend equal numbers of time in each cycle? Are there really four cycles? Are there really five cycles? But, you know, we were relatively happy with this data.
So, Ramya and Tal have mentioned a little bit about this macronucleus. And actually, this was the thing that I got really excited about when I started thinking about paramecium, which was, I think, an incredible kind of genome organization that it has that I still have a lot of questions about. So let me just tell you a little bit about that. So the paramecium, here's this little schematic here that we showed before, actually has generally three nuclei containing DNA. So there's two sort of germline micronuclei that are usually called the mics. And these have no transcription. And they can each contain a diploid copy of the whole genome that's stored in about 50 to 60 chromosomes. And these are what actually replicate during the sexual phase of its cycle. And there's also a somatic macronucleus, usually denoted as the Mac, called the Big Mac, if you want. And that was this thing we saw that was floating around before. And this is where all the transcription actually takes place. But it's very different from the micronuclei in the sense that it has about 200 distinct chromosomes, and they're actually stripped of a lot of regions that are present in the mic genome, like, I think, you know, intergenic regions and transposons and whatnot. And each of these chromosomes are present in about 800 copies, so it's super-duper polyploid. And as you see in this little schematic here, the Mac is this big thing, you know, present in the cell, and it moves around a whole bunch during the straining process, as we showed. And the mics are very little small structures within it, and usually they're kind of scattered about. They're pretty hard to see in any of these images and videos. So one thing I spent quite a bit of time doing, actually, and this whole slide shows all that time, which was just trying to actually stain these macronuclei to see what they look like. So we troubleshooted a lot with different DNA dyes, and this one is DAPI that definitely worked the best. And you see the Macs in three different species of paramecium here. This is Paramecium tetraurelia. So here's the Mac here. You can't see the mics usually in most of these. This is Paramecium multimicronucleatum. Here's the Mac here. And then finally, this is Paramecium caudatum, and here's its Mac. This might be a mic, I'm not sure, but they were usually not noticeable in these images. So the thing that I think is really cool about the Mac is one of the sort of processes that paramecium can do is called vegetative fission. And this is an asexual mode of reproduction. And as far as we know, what happens here is basically the Mac splits into two, and its chromosomal contents are just partitioned between two new offspring macronuclei. And so we were lucky enough to actually capture this process happening in the act one time. So this is Paramecium caudatum, and you see here's the Mac. You know, here's one going to this cell and one going to this cell, and it's sort of all smeared out while this is in the midst of the process. And I think, you know, this process raises a lot of really interesting questions about how this affects, you know, the population genetics of a population of paramecium. And so in particular, you know, how does this affect the copy numbers of all of these different chromosomes in paramecium? You know, if it's just partitioning them into two, you know, do you always have 800 copies of each one, or there's probably some distribution about that, right? And how is this different not only within a population of paramecium, but between different species? You know, there are species from before various whole genome duplications that occurred in paramecium, species that are after it, are those different? Another question that I think is really exciting is whether this process is controlled at all. So this is an amitotic process. So there's no spindle, there's none of that stuff happening. As far as anyone kind of knows, it might just be kind of random, uncontrolled. So if you're doing that, how, you know, how does this happen if there's no regulation of this process? And in particular, how can you prevent cell death from aneuploidy? So if you're just randomly partitioning, you know, there's some probability that sometimes one of the new Macs is just going to get zero copies of a chromosome. And if that contains essential genes, then that new cell would probably die. And is this possibility of aneuploidy related at all to senescence or aging in paramecium, where some cell lines just eventually die
if they don't undergo sexual reproduction. So, okay, I couldn't help myself, so I did a little bit of simple modeling with this, very quickly, and I wanted to write down a simple possible model of this to see, can this tell us anything about the data that we would later collect? So let's assume that each cell in this population has 200 distinct chromosomes, and they'll each start at 800 copies each. These are the parameters for Paramecium tetraurelia, but you can use different parameters in other species if you're interested. So at each time step of this model, a cell is randomly chosen, and that will undergo this vegetative fission, and every chromosome in that parent cell will be randomly assigned to one of the two new offspring. So it's just a binomial sampling process. And then you'll also assume that those copy numbers are all doubled just to keep the total average amount of DNA per cell fixed. So then if a cell gets zero copies of any chromosome, you say that cell dies. It's not viable. And you should also choose cells to randomly die if the population exceeds some maximum threshold, like 1,000, assuming there's finite resources available to it. So schematically, the process looks something like this, that you have a cell that has, say, three red chromosomes, two green ones. They randomly get partitioned. This one got one red one and two green ones. And this one got two red ones and no green ones. So that one will die. So I just did a couple very quick little simulations of this to see what would happen. So here you see time in overlapping generations here, since this is sort of a Moran-like model. And on this left axis here in blue, this is the copy number per chromosome. So it starts at 800. And the dark blue is the mean, and the light blue is one standard deviation around that. And as you see, it generally increases on average because lineages that drift down to low copy number get purged from the population because they're more likely to have non-viable offspring. There's this distribution around it, but it's actually pretty tight. But there is, of course, even though that often goes up, at least transiently at the beginning, there is genetic drift. This is only a population of size 1,000, so it can go up and down and different things. But also, this one thing that's sort of misleading about this is, this is one standard deviation away, but there's actually other lineages that are drifting down to very, very low copy numbers. And that's the source of a huge number of deaths from aneuploidy. So this red line here corresponds to the right axis, and this is the cumulative deaths from this aneuploidy when you didn't get enough copies of any one chromosome, and that really starts piling up, and that's because there's these lineages that end up with like two copy numbers, and then basically one of the offspring is very likely to have zero. So finally, now if we want to know what the distribution within a population of copy numbers would be, we can take just like one snapshot here. So if we look at just the 500,000th time point of this, here's the distribution of copy number per chromosome in the population there. So, to characterize this in sort of a, unit-free way, we can look at a couple dimensionless characteristic parameters of the distribution. So the coefficient of variation here, which is the standard deviation over the mean, for this distribution is about 1 to 2%. So it's pretty narrow, and you can see that here. It's a pretty narrow distribution around the mean. And also, if you look at the skewness in kurtosis, which is basically the third and fourth standardized moment of the distribution, so you subtract off the mean and normalize by the standard deviation, these are consistent with a Gaussian. So a Gaussian would have 0 here because it's symmetric around the mean, and it would be 3. This is actually 3.01 or something. So this is pretty close to Gaussian is the point. So this is our prediction on what we think the distribution of copy numbers would be like within a population of Paramecium. So how to actually measure this in a real population? Well, we need to measure macronuclear DNA content across the population, so we wanted to use flow cytometry for this. So if we can dye the DNA and just dye the DNA in the macronucleus, then we can run these guys through the flow cytometer and actually see what this distribution would be across a population. We can try different species and whatnot. So here's a little schematic of how a flow cytometer works. Basically, you have your sample, and it consists of cells or particles of some kind, and they flow through this stream of fluid, and then you blast them with lasers, like all good experiments. And one laser, you can use with a detector on the other side to just determine how big the object is. Basically, it's called the time of flight, how long it takes to go past your detector. And then also you can blast them with lasers of different wavelengths and then look at the emission from the object, and you can use that to tell how much fluorescence it has. So if you dye your DNA, you can use this to determine how much DNA content there is. So to see how much we could really actually use this data, I wanted to do a very simple calibration test with this. And again, physicists love spheres, so let's run this with beads that we know are just 42 microns each. They fluoresce really brightly. So if you run these through the flow cytometer, this is several thousand events. You get a scatter plot that looks like this. On this axis is time of flight, which is a proxy for the size of the object. On this axis is the total green fluorescence. And you get points like this. And we believe that these, you know, you see these nice little clusters. And so we thought, OK, this cluster here, these are all the single beads. This cluster here are two beads stuck together. This cluster here are three or more beads stuck together. And this stuff here is just junk, you know, very low fluorescence, but all sorts of different sizes. So what we did then, the other great thing about the flow cytometer is you can run through all these events, but then you can actually sort them out at the end. You can say, let's pick out a couple guys here, 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 and here, and look at them under the microscope to see if we're getting what we think we are. So we did that. And, well, before I show that, really, these categories were perfect classifications. Everything here was one bead. Everything here was two beads. Everything here was three or more beads. There were no beads here. So the flow cytometer was, I think, did a great job at distinguishing between, you know, certainly within a factor of two in terms of size and also fluorescence. No question. So now one of the other things I wanted to do was actually look at within one of these, how well are you really resolving differences between single beads? So after sorting out the single beads, we can take pictures of them under the microscope and actually try to correlate that data to what the flow cytometer thinks it's seeing. So that's what's shown here. So on the top plot here, this shows the diameter measured of the beads of the microscope, the time of flight measured from the flow cytometer. Down here is the total fluorescence from the microscope, total fluorescence from the flow cytometer. And as you see, there's, if you ignore these points, really, there's no correlation here. And this, I would say, is really just the intrinsic noise of the two instruments, the microscope and the flow cytometer. You know, the beads are probably not all exactly the same size or same fluorescence, but you know, the manufacturers are probably a lot better at that than our resolution on these instruments. So I would say anything you're seeing here is just the intrinsic variability in your ability to measure these things, you know, from these two instruments. So if you calculate the coefficient of variation for these two measurements from each of these instruments, you get these numbers here. And they're quite small. They're just a few percent each. But actually, I was pretty surprised to see the flow cytometer has a slightly lower coefficient of variation than my microscope images. For both quantities, size and fluorescence. And granted, this was very simple image analysis, and probably one could do a much better job at that. But I think, you know, to me, this was a testament that if you can actually filter out your events in this way, you can get pretty good quantitative data from the flow cytometer. So finally, I wanted to do this to actual cells of paramecium with their DNA dyed fluorescently. So now you get data that looks like this. It's a lot messier, as you can see. It doesn't cluster so nicely. So we thought, maybe this cluster here was likely to be cells. So unfortunately, when we sorted these out, we got a lot of stuff that wasn't cells. But we think that when we redid this experiment last night, we saw that that was a lot of stuff down here. And probably actually, if you cut out a lot of that stuff and start looking at things up here, you would get a pretty pure sample of cells. So some more calibration is necessary there. But just to proceed on, you know, I took all the events here and just look at the distribution of fluorescence to see if I could compare that at all to the model I showed you before. So of those putative cells, here's the distribution of total fluorescence from them. So as you see, the coefficient of variation for this is much higher than it was predicted by the model. So that predicted just a couple percent. This is much higher. So this is a pretty broad distribution. But I think that's what you expect because, you know, there's a lot of non-cells in here probably. So there's all this additive noise going on. So you need to filter that out and maybe, and then for sure this would go down. But it's still pretty Gaussian. So if you look at the skewness and kurtosis, they're still roughly consistent with a Gaussian distribution. So I think with better calibration of this, you could probably get better measurements.
And this is Nian, and we would like to thank Kevin and especially Lydia for being a participant and facilitating and helping us answer whatever questions we could come up with. So thank you.
Question. Tal.
Yes.
Do your paramecium eat your whatever non-moving fluorescence?
Do they eat the goof cat stuff? Absolutely. Yes. They. So I did two experiments. I did one wherever I didn't have a cover slip, which meant that as I ran it overnight, it was actually the well was drying out from the center out. And that one was really nice because everything in the center was definitely poop and not paramecium. They couldn't eat that. And I did another experiment with the cover well on. The problem here is that they poop and it immediately diffuses out. So it's a lot, my signal was a lot lower, but it had the exact same shape as last time. That's actually why I didn't have a y-axis. But that's why as time goes on, I get more, it gets more crazy and I get more uncertain about the data. So I just kind of focused on the first 700 minutes.
All right.
Well, sorry, can I
Ask a question. So do you think one would have to worry about variability of DAPI staining? Like you really want to measure...
Absolutely, DNA. Yeah. The staining was a huge challenge for this. We tried like 9, 10 different DNA stains, and the one we actually used for the flow cytometer was definitely suboptimal, which was a major problem. And the DAPI one worked a lot better, but unfortunately the flow cytometer doesn't have a blue laser. So that would be a major thing to do in the future, to really like get a good handle on how much you have to use to get like really consistent staining. That's definitely a big problem.
Well, let's take a break until 11, let's say, and then we'll continue with the two remaining groups. Thank you guys.